I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. What do we make of the drop in stocks and mutual funds? Our experts are here to offer perspective. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. If you're lucky enough to have investments in mutual funds and you see the indicators falling, what do you do? You're especially concerned if you plan to retire. Is this a bump, or are we headed for a long-term roller coaster ride? Gold is often protection when the stock market slides. Is it still the case? Bob and Charlie Kreitler are here from Kreitler Financial, a wealth management firm in New Haven affiliated with Raymond James, though Bob and Charlie's views are their own. Welcome back. It's great to have you here. So, Bob or Charlie, where are we right now in the markets? I've got my phone on right now. I'm just checking the stock, and I'm seeing the stock, the indexes. And I'm seeing that the Dow is at 15,451 almost. So it's up 77, almost 78 points, although the markets close in about 55 minutes. But right now, it looks okay. So at 15,450, what's going on, do you think?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is, we're seeing a pretty good day, 0.5% up. But in the context of what's been a pretty rocky start to a year, with the markets off about 5%. And this has sort of reawakened people to the idea that, yeah, there's some risk out there. Coming off of what was a phenomenal year last year, I believe it was the best for the S&P 500 since about 97.
Yeah, what was that? What was the growth? 20-something percent?
With the dividends, I think we saw over 30%, 32% or something for the S&P 500. And I apologize, I don't have any precise numbers on that. But it was an outstanding year, certainly one that we don't get very often. So that it's the kind of thing, when you do get them, you have to smile and enjoy it.
Well, here's the everybody's asking. When you see the market, as we've seen in the past few days, drop at 1.300 points, people take an in-breath. So what would cause that? What's happening? Are investors, major institutional investors, you know, the big folks, taking profits for some reason? Is this what they call a correction in the market, where you see people taking profits and then things even out a little bit? What's going on, Bob?
Well, I think the first thing is that corrections like this, or drops in the markets, are normal. And what we have been through since 2009 is a market that just goes up and up and up. That's not normal. And what is normal is to go through periods of time that it goes off. And most years the stock market is up, and a 10% correction is very normal. And we haven't even had that yet. And we've just gotten used to the market going up and up and up without down. But it's going to be volatile.
But can you say what this is? Is it a correction? Is it taking profits? Or are we at the start of what you folks call a growly market that's going to be a roller coaster ride? Can you know the answer to that at this point?
I think the answer is you don't know. You can watch lots of TV programs, and every person out there will give you different explanations going on. But it's very normal after a period of going up that people are saying, well, it's gone too much. Or they'll start looking at negative things that are happening around the world, and there's a lot of negative things that are happening around the world. And remember that the stock market is a forecaster of what's going to happen rather than the actual event itself. So the market's always trying to predict in advance. So we're not at all concerned at this point in time that the market's off 5% on the year. We're saying, well, it's been a long time since we've had something like this. This is At this point, it is normal. Now, we listen to a lot of different people, and most people we're listening to think it's just a correction, and it's not the beginning of something really big.
Ah, is that so?
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to know. So you're hearing upstairs, as they say, from analysts like yourselves. Everybody thinks, looking at data, at real data, that this is a correction rather than the start of some trouble.
They're not the big economic and other factors around there that are usually sort of typical of the beginning of a really major bear market.
Well, aren't there a number of economic indicators, Charlie, that look really good?
I think we're in a period where U.S. economic growth has continued to surprise a lot of the naysayers out there. Now, the numbers aren't great. When we look at growth in the neighborhood of, you know, 1.5, 1.9, 2.5%, I mean, that's sort of where we've been stuck. And these are certainly not great numbers, but they are growth. And we have to keep that in perspective. Now, something that the markets, I think, have already one of the issues we're always questioning is how much news has already been priced into the markets, how much of it's already baked into those prices. And I think, you know, there's some things that we're going to see coming out of the growth numbers this year that are likely to be positive surprises to many people. But for example, last year we were dealing with a pretty significant drag on the economy due to the sequester, some of the drawback in government spending. And this year, while that spending's not coming back necessarily, when we do a year-over-year comparison, it's no longer going to be a negative. So meanwhile, the private economy last year was actually growing at a pretty robust rate, being dragged down by those federal spending numbers, local spending numbers, and so on. This year, that drag is going to be gone. So I think we're going to start seeing some better growth numbers coming out of this calendar year. But remember, the markets are a forecasting instrument. So the markets are always looking ahead. And again, this is not a surprise.
That's the part I don't understand. When you both say the markets are forecasting, they're looking ahead. What are they looking ahead at? How are these numbers what they are?
An investor is always buying only if he thinks it's going to be going up into the future. So he's looking at some reason why the stock or the bonds that we're dealing with is going to go up. And so he's jumping ahead 6 months, a year, 2 years and buying it, saying, I think it's going to be better in the future, therefore I'm going to be buying it. So that's mm-hmm. what drives the pricing. You only want to buy something if you think it's going to be going up, I think.
Okay, so I want to talk about what's going on around the world. If we look at two of the biggest players, India and China, huge markets with their own indexes. So as Bob Kreitler, as you've pointed out many, many times through the, 12 years that you've been on the show, we're not the only stock market over here. There are how many around the world?
I don't even know what the numbers are. They break them into
hundreds.
Developed and then they break them into emerging markets.
Okay. So if we look at, say, India and China, we see, I gather from what I'm hearing and reading, that China is saying it's going to have some average growth. They're finally making some financial reforms. People seem in this country to believe that these are real, not manipulated. And so they don't think it's going to be a stunning success over there, manipulated or not, and they don't think it's going to be horrible. It's going to be kind of average in China. And then I started hearing about India. In India, I'm in much more trouble. Then I've been watching carefully what's happening in Argentina. Argentina, they're actually having a bit of a run on the banks. And money, people are trying to park their money outside the country as fast as they can. And suddenly the United States is looking like the safest place. Does that seem to fit in with what you're hearing?
I think the answer is yes. And the question is, what's going to happen tomorrow? Because investors have already been doing this for some time. It's interesting to look at the emerging markets. As a general rule, the emerging markets have benefited, we think, a great deal because of the U.S. Federal Reserve making interest rates very low. So money has flowed into these developing emerging markets, and they have done very, very well. Last spring, when there were hiccups about worrying about increasing interest rates, the developing markets took a big hit, much bigger than some of the other countries. So they tend to be more sensitive to this. Now, the question then is, what's going to happen in the future? And one of the things you have to recognize, I mean, you've run off a couple countries, and every country seems to be doing it differently. So there may be some emerging markets that are doing better than others. I think Argentina may be an example of one that's having continuing problems.
What is an emerging market? What of the countries I mentioned, who's considered an emerging market?
I tell you, the definition on that continues to evolve and change. And I mean, I can remember going back 15 years and everyone was talking about the Asian tigers, which was including some of these nations like Korea. South Korea, of course, now is virtually a developed market, very advanced economy. One of the things I think investors here in this country have a tendency to do is we tend to look at the emerging markets as one entity, as if they were the United States or as if they were Europe. And the reality is they're very different nations with very different market conditions. The three big ones that you mentioned, China, India, and Argentina, I think are terrific examples of just how varied that can be. And one of the key differences between those three is their dependence on foreign capital. Argentina right now is having major problems because they owe a lot of money in other currencies. So their currency, the peso, has been under pressure, and suddenly they're finding it very difficult to defend that. So I think they seem to go through a devaluation of their currency. It seems like clockwork about every 10 years, which, of course, punishes those people who have a lot of money in the local currency. It's a way of trying to get yourself out of debt.
Let me tell you why. I'm talking with Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven. And I wanted to get you to talk about the recent drop, the roller coaster ride in these recent days. Because there are people, with baby boomers retiring at the rate they are, there are people who are right on the verge of retiring or perhaps who just retired. And the answer to that question about whether you think this is the start of a very troubled market or maybe it's going to be a little bumpy, this is vitally important to people. Now, you would think if somebody's on the verge of retiring, you've already switched over and gotten much more conservative, correct?
That, depending on the situation, but that's the general rule that when you stop saving and you're planning to start pulling money out of your portfolio, you do not want that portfolio bouncing around a lot. So the answer is generally you want to become more conservative when you start taking money out.
And I'm asking about that because with the market having done so extraordinarily well this past year, almost 30%, right, Charlie? I started to hear some retired people say, you know, over drinks, well, you know, I've been happy being conservative, but I think I'm going to talk to my financial analyst and say, let's get a little more aggressive. So the last time I saw this happen was back in the 80s and in the 90s when things really took off under Clinton. And, you know, everything was so hot. People were buying stocks that actually didn't even exist practically. And jumping in at the last minute, now those stocks then started to fall because they'd already had their increases. And I'm starting to get a whiff of that conversation again. Maybe not in the past 3 days, but, you know, I'm hearing people thinking, well, maybe I don't have to be so conservative, even if I am retired. Are you hearing any of that?
I think you hear that all the time. Now, when we started talking earlier, we said that we thought that this was probably a market correction, which means that we have at least a year or multiple years for the market to continue to move upward. So the people we're listening to that we have a great deal of respect for are saying we think the odds are very good that this is continuing to be a bull market. And if that's the case, then you do not want to be making major reductions in your portfolio. Now, however, it's also terribly important to understand that no one knows exactly what's going to happen in the future. And you have to structure a portfolio that's going to let you retire if that's what you want to do, even if Bob and Charlie Kreitler are wrong on this thing. So you cannot be in a position of let's say, going all to stocks and then tomorrow retiring and finding out your portfolio has dropped by 30, 40%. We don't think that's going to happen, but it's important as a manager of your retirement plan, things like that, that you prepare for that. And you don't want too much. That's for the reasons we don't have 100% in stocks except in limited number of portfolios where someone can deal with that.
So I want to talk with you both about gold, whether that's still what they call a hedge, a good hedge. I want to talk about if you're heading toward retirement, how aggressive do you get to be? And we'd love to invite you to ask questions of our financial analyst, 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR, and we'll be right back.
Take something, that ain't working, that's the way you do it. wanting it gets on MTV. That ain't working. That's the way to get your money for nothing and chicks for free. Get your money for nothing.
You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. And if it's food you're interested in, you will see the link to the Food Schmooze. Lots and lots of people checking that out. Also, thank you for listening with my guests. We have Bob and Charlie Kreitler. Wealth Management, Kreitler Financial in New Haven. We're talking about how to protect and grow your money. Market's been a little bit bumpy. People wondering, does it signal something concerning, or are people just taking profits right now? It sounds like from this first segment of the show that my guests, they can't know for absolutely certain, but they think that the year ahead looks pretty good. And so people possibly taking profits right now. We just checked stocks and we see that they're up, I think, about 79 points, closing at 4 o'clock. So let's get to gold. And we invite you, if you have a question about finances, please call in and ask your question now. Bob Kreitler has been on the show for about 12 years, we think, and really has given his time all these years just to educate people as much as possible. And so everybody is here, and this is true in so many professions, people coming on the show to offer the best advice they can. So gold is often seen as a protection. When the markets are funny, you know, people will say, oh, it's a hedge. Go to gold if the markets are down. And so I've always remembered that slogan. And yet I see, Bob, that you've been a little cool on gold for some time now. Do you still feel that way?
Yes. And about a year ago, we really got entirely out of gold. But gold is very, very special. It's sort of very, very unique. The only thing that's close to it is silver, but we don't even treat it like a normal commodity. But over time, gold has been a wonderful place to go to protect your capital against all kinds of things going wrong in the world. And it has hundreds or thousands of years of history of doing this. Now, our concern at this point is it seems to be so volatile that the cost of hedging seems to be high. And so we're just saying, you know, it's too expensive to get in at this point in time to own it. And we're hoping to be able to get back in sometime in the future where we don't think we're going to have quite the volatility that we've had.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, if you had a chunk of money, either through inheritance or bonus or whatever it might be, how would you invest that money? Would you, what they call dollar cost average it, where you put in a little and then you wait a little bit and then you put in another third of that money and you wait a little bit, and so that if your mutual funds are rising and falling in value, you've kind of averaged out the gain and the loss by doing it that way? Or at this point in the market, say it's down right now, would you just throw it all in there?
Boy, I think that's a question on an investor's time horizon. How long is it going to be? How sensitive are they to those ups and downs? Interestingly, the longer you go, the less it matters. I mean, if we were going to look into an investment that we were going to hold for 20 years, what's a couple percentage points? If it's something that we're going to be very sensitive to over the course of 12 months, well, it certainly is like having a security blanket to know that I may be doing the wrong thing right now by putting the money in if the market's going to drop, but I know I'm going to be doing the right thing too. So, of course, there's a little bit of bitter irony to this because it guarantees I'm also going to be doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. So in the end, what would you do?
Another advantage of dollar cost averaging is it's psychological. you don't feel like you're making the jump entirely. You're spreading out over time. And psychology in investing is terribly important. You have to understand it. And an awful lot of people don't do well because there's something happens psychologically. They say, well, you know, the market's off all this year. I need to take profits. I'm going to totally get out. And that to me is very much a psychological reaction. And the dollar cost averaging is a way to sort of hedge your bets of saying, I'm only going to put some in, and then I'm going to do another 3 months, another 3 months. And now, are you betting that the market goes up or you want it to go down? And actually, you should be betting that it goes down, because then you're going to buy more.
Ah, this brings me to a person I know who, when the market is falling, as it's done in the past few days, you know, dramatically, he buys like crazy. And when it's peaking and has had, you know, a good run and is really up there, he's selling everything. And he keeps buying, you know, buying low. And he said to me, I've just made so much money this way. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, isn't that what's called market timing, where you try and guess as you're doing this? And that can be a little bit dangerous, yet I can't deny that he's done well with this.
It's an interesting challenge. Now, in his case, it sounds like he's been successful and he's been able to counter all the psychological issues that usually make you go the reverse of this. But I think there are relatively few people can do that. And the numbers consistently show that people sell at the bottom and buy at the tops, and they lose a great deal of market performance by mistiming. So he sounds like he's an exception, and maybe we need to hire him.
I actually have a chart up on the wall in my office which talks about investor psychology. And we have a natural tendency, when things have done well, to say, well, I want more of that. So the stock market just went up by 30% in 2013. Well, I should be buying stocks. And of course, the beginning of 2013 would have been a great time to have owned those stocks. I'm thinking about buying today. But the reverse happens too. As the market starts to fall, people naturally feel fearful, less confident. I think the worst emotion on this little chart showing the cycle of emotions is despondency. But of course, this is a natural human reaction. And it leads us to do the opposite of what we should be doing, which is what your friend is doing, which we should be buying when things are cheap. We should be selling when things are expensive. The problem is having the wisdom to know which is which.
Yeah, I think his strategy is, when the prices, he's bought something and the prices are starting to go up and up, you know, the question is, how high is up? And he will think, well, maybe it'll go up even higher, but that's enough for me. So I think, you know, oh, wow, that's a nice gain. I think I'll take my profits right now, and then I'm just going to park my money and sit there and wait. Then he waits for the drop and jumps right back in again and buys, as he has been in the past couple of days, you know, because the prices have dropped so much.
And there are a lot of people that try this, and there are relatively few that are able to succeed at doing it year in and year out.
And it's called market timing.
Market timing, and there's all kinds of technical analysis and ways of trying to improve it. But there are a lot of people that spend a lot of time on this.
I've seen people also who think they're pretty good at it, and then comes that day when a big mistake is made that you couldn't foresee that something was going to happen, and not only then they're in big trouble. Okay, so let's get into phone number, 203-776-WNPR. If you're interested in, you know, where your investment should be at this stage we're in, small cap, large cap, international funds, 203-776-9677. We're not really talking about individual stocks because my guests are into mutual funds. Let me ask you that question. Why do you think mutual funds are better than buying individual stocks?
I'm not sure that they're, quote, better. But with a mutual fund, you're letting someone else make the decision on which stocks to buy and sell. And they're doing it 12 hours a day, 24 hours a day to try and figure out what to do. And you can find a track record on how well they have done. And they have a wealth of information that individuals cannot have. So our that's the structure that we normally do. There are some people that do that pick individual stocks and they do fine with it. Sure.
Well, so not to put you on the defensive, but why do people hire financial analysts, financial planners, your wealth management people? Why don't people just put the money into index funds or pick one of the houses, I don't know, Fidelity or whatever it might be, and say, I'm just going with it? Why is it worth paying fees? And I don't mean each time you buy and sell a stock, because I think that's probably not cost effective, but a management fee per quarter or portion of the year. What is it we get from that kind of operation as opposed to just putting the money in an index fund over 20 years?
Well, the index funds are obviously a low-cost way of investing, and not a no-cost way of investing, but a low-cost way of investing. So what the active manager's value proposition is that they are going to be better than the index. The index is an average. Well, let's pick one. If we look at, say, the S&P 500, there's 500 companies that make up that index. And an active manager can outperform that by picking only the best ones, or they can outperform it by picking only the worst ones. Now, there are going to be times when active management has generally done better in history. There are other times when the index funds have generally done better. I tend to, you know, that active-passive debate, I think because there's times when one works, times when the other works, that it really is a lot more noise or tempest in a teapot, if you will, than it perhaps is a true fundamental issue. I think the importance is to have a strategy and to stay with it rather than jumping in and out, focusing on asset allocation, some of those bigger picture issues first, and then worrying about some of the more fine program or fine details.
So the phrase wealth management also means, I mean, this is also something where a person's assets aren't just a stock portfolio, but the kind of insurance you have, the way taxes get managed, whether there is a trust, what kind of will, and on it goes, whether you're leveraged in terms of your house. This is looking at someone's whole financial life and then being able to balance a portfolio based on where it stands across that whole spectrum I just mentioned.
That's correct. And it's interesting that in the last year, year and a half, there have been numerous studies out that show what additional net impact the financial planner can have on the portfolio. And through Morningstar, there's something called Gamma that they're using. I just saw another press release coming out of, the president of Vanguard, saying that a financial advisor will add 3-4% additional return over what you're going to get otherwise. And some of the things that are happening is we were talking about the buying and the selling, and the financial advisor can provide a much evener keel for this, so you're not jumping in and jumping out at the wrong times. There's some of that going on. We do an awful lot in terms of doing different things in taxable accounts versus IRAs and 401ks because of the tax treatment, and decisions on which account you're going to take money out of. And some of the impact from this is very, very substantial. And when you hire a financial advisor, they're presumably helping you with some of these issues.
Walter Faith Middleton with Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial. Go ahead, Walter.
Well, my question is actually two questions closely related. One is, how closely coupled do you think the quantitative easing is to the markets going up and down? And the second question is, where did all that quantitative easing money go, and is it likely to come out and turn into inflation?
Okay, so let's handle quantitative easing first.
Do you want to start, Charlie?
Sure. Walter, I think you're identifying a terrific question, and that is, what happens when the biggest buyer in the bond market has no sensitivity whatsoever to the price they pay? This can cause serious distortions, which can be good or bad. And I think it's very clear that a lot of the money that has been pushed out by the Fed has been raising the market prices, both within the bond markets and within the equity markets. And the Fed's made no bones about it. This is their goal. Their goal has been to push the markets up so that people can feel a little more confident, and so that the average Americans, because their house price is doing better, because their retirement account is doing better, that they're going to be willing to go out and start spending. And that's what makes the economy go round. So there's no question in my mind that the quantitative easing or the other extraordinary programs that the Fed has done has had an impact. Now, the great unknown is what happens as we start to unwind this. And I think the Fed has a lot of flexibility with regard to the timing of that. They've surprised the markets a little bit last summer when the markets tried to anticipate what the Fed was going to do, when, of course, the Fed wasn't ready to move yet. So it's sort of an interesting situation where the markets are guessing what the Fed is going to do. The Fed is trying to guess what the markets are going to do.
And the new chair, Janet Yellen, is at least people are predicting from what they know of her that she will continue in Bernanke's path, so to speak. So if there's going to be any unwinding of quantitative easing, it'll be in a very easy fashion. Does that seem right?
I think that's right. And one of the things that's interesting is the U.S. dollar is the world currency. And because of that, the U.S., meaning the Federal Reserve, has huge flexibility and has very few constraints on it, which is good and it's bad. It's good in terms of their ability to get out of this thing. So we do have that.
So is that going to mean a drop in the price of stocks? Are we going to see that even though the market seems so sensitive to every little tweak, they just have to say the sentence and stock prices are falling. Gains are falling. So what?
Well, we've had an interesting change. It used to be that any time that there was bad economic news, the markets went up. And it was because the markets were betting the Fed was going to come to the rescue. And for the last 6 months or so, we've had the reverse. Now, when the markets have heard bad news, the markets have dropped. And when the markets have heard good news, the markets went up. This is a positive change. And it says maybe we're becoming a little less dependent on the Fed. And I say a little less because there's still a tremendous amount of money that's out there in the system because of these extraordinary actions.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Bob and Charlie Kreitler, financial analysts, talking about this economy, how to protect and grow your money. We'll be right back. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FAITHWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We have Bob and Charlie Kreitler here, financial planners at Kreitler Financial in New Haven. And we're talking about how to protect and grow your money. The markets have been a little rowdy lately, and it's a change from what's gone on in the past year. And so people are grumbling a little bit, getting a little nervous. And the whole question, reason we've had them in, is to see if we can get at whether this signals something significant. Or are people just taking profits? Or is it something more serious where we're going into a very turbulent, if not bear market, where things are troubling for a long time? And so far, I think my guests think that people are taking profits, and there's not a sign, even though you can't know for sure, that this is going to be a bad market this year. So our last caller, who dialed 203-776- 9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. Asked us part two, what to say something about whether we thought inflation was going to be trouble as the Fed starts to ease up a bit on their interventions. You know, there's always a danger that inflation will just take off, and it has been so low now for so long and defied people's predictions. So what do you think, Bob?
Well, I think first of all, inflation will return to normal at some point in the future. So that's almost separate from the question of is this going to be an inflationary policy to get out of what the Fed's doing. Another point is that the Federal Reserve is not tightening yet. All they're doing is doing less easing. So we have a large amount to swing. And as I had commented earlier, the Fed has huge flexibility, and there are really no constraints on it. So it may take years to eventually get out of this, get out of the situation of having bought so much in the way of bonds from all different kinds of organizations from around the world. I think eventually inflation may be the solution that they use to get out of this. And I don't know whether it's 2 years from now or whether they're going to spend 20 years unraveling this great experiment that they have done. And I also point out, I mean, I think I'm in the camp of saying this great experiment has prevented the United States and the world from going into a depression. So that's very positive. At the same time, what they've done has slowed the recovery, I think, a great deal because of all the actions that we're going. We're in a great experiment.
Well, I wonder about bonds. Bonds have been in trouble for quite some time. And is that changing at all?
Charlie, you want to take this one?
Well, sure. This is kind of the $64,000 question. The bond markets have been in a period now for the last 1 to 2 years with some historically low interest rates. And this creates a number of dilemmas for investors. If bond interest rates go up, bond prices will fall. That's bond math. So if you believe that interest rates are going to continue to rise, then we have to be somewhat measured in our expectations of what bonds can do. Now, meanwhile, we've all been told that as a retiree, I'm supposed to own a lot of bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So, boy, this creates an interesting question. On the one hand, I have equities with all the potential return and all the potential risk that goes with them. On the other hand, I've got this bond that I can go out and I can get a 10-year bond today. It's going to be yielding less than 3%. And now my base assumption is that if I own that and I hold it for 10 years, I'm going to get a 3% return before inflation. That's not terribly appealing. On the other hand, with inflation as low, it does mean I'm actually getting a return. So investors today, they're really sort of stuck. You know, do I think that bond yields are going to rise pretty quickly, in which case there's a significant amount more risk to bonds than is normally perceived? Do I think they're going to stay where they are or rise slowly? That might not be so bad. On the other hand, if we go through a major market crisis, something like the fear we're seeing out of the emerging markets, what if it spreads? Well, bonds can provide a nice bit of shelter for us. So investors are sort of questioning today, well, should I be continuing to put money in bonds? What strategies should I use to do that? This is not an easy question, Faith. This is tough.
This gets to people who are thinking about, you know, starting to make a plan for retirement or have just retired. The question of whether you have a segment of your portfolio that is aimed at growth. The old-fashioned way was that you would just be so ultra-conservative when you retired, not thinking, well, my money is still making money. You just wanted, there was no risk. You absolutely did not want to explore growth because you really could hurt your principal. So what's the philosophy these days? Same? Or do you think to yourself, well, I want some of my money to grow?
Well, I think it's important to look at total return of a portfolio. And the dilemma we have is that we're having very low expectations on bonds and we sort of like stocks, but we know a bad market in stocks is like minus 40%. Well, a bad market in bonds is like minus 2 or 3%. So that's the reason that bonds are in portfolios. But yes, I think a retiree can have some portion of the portfolio in stocks. And remember, retirees may be looking at, 20 or 30 years or something like this. So it's not a short term. It's not a short term.
Mark, thanks for calling 203-776-9677. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a stereo that's real. I have $125,000 parked in a savings account. I have a short-term goal. What do I do with that money?
How short-term goal is this, Mark?
5 years.
Okay, so that's sort of intermediate term. And so the dilemma that you've got is if with the CD, you're probably getting an extraordinarily low interest rate. If you put a small portion of it into something like stocks, then we would hope that over that period of time you might get something more positive than that. But there's also a chance that you might lose it. And you have to sort of think, how important is it at the end of the day, I have the $120,000. Can I afford to have some of it that I can risk? And so that's, you've got to be able to answer that question, I think, in order to figure out whether you can put some in the stocks.
And if it didn't go according to plan, would it be okay if it was 6 years or 7 years?
I would believe that I could stand some risk with no problem, 20%.
Sounds like a reasonable solution.
Okay.
The dilemma we all have is we do not know what the future is. Now, you know how important it is to have the $120,000 over 5 years, 6 years, or 7 years, or whether the $120,000 really could go to $100,000. But my mission really is to take the $120,000, have it go to $130,000 or $140,000.
I gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you, Mark. To what degree are we hardwired as human beings to assume that good things are going to happen to that $120,000? This is why people go to financial planners or go to smart people. You know, are we wired to expect that the outcome is going to be good?
I think there's a lot of wiring going on, and that's why there's so much psychological sort of evaluating of what investors are like. There's always the tendency of whatever happened the last year that's going to continue into the future. That's sort of a given. There's benchmarking. If you want to sell your house and your neighbor says it's worth $300,000, that's become benchmark, and you don't want to get $290,000 for it. There are all kinds of psychological things that happen that frequently can hurt you in the investing.
And so one of the worst things is hanging on to dog stocks, where this is something really that you should get out of. And the psychology is for a lot of us is to say, those of us who don't know what we're doing, to say, I'm just going to sit here with this fund or stock until it comes back and reaches the level it used to be, and then I would have repaired my terrible situation.
That's the benchmarking I was talking about.
So the idea is it's time to get rid of it when something like that is happening. David, Faith Middleton with Bob and Charlie Kreitler, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was just wondering, I have chosen to invest in MLPs rather than bonds at this time. Since MLPs, I'm averaging about 6% a year in distribution, and rather than the bonds. And even if the stock, the MLP itself, goes down, I can afford to wait for it to come back up because I'm still getting 6%. So my question is, what are your thoughts about investing in either MLPs or, in general, dividend growth stocks?
All right, so let's get at what an MLT is.
Well, master limited partnerships are basically a tax structure under which you can invest, and they have generally had higher payouts. The popular ones these days seem to be related to a lot of the energy infrastructure, a lot of this energy revolution that's been going on. Interestingly, they're the same sort of tax structure that have been used in some things like accounting firms over time. So it's basically just another type of ownership structure, and the payout, the ratios on them have been pretty favorable. I kind of view them as more similar in terms of their risk structure as to equities, as to bonds. And, you know, again, with any of these things, you know, we're talking about the vehicle through which we invest, but it's really important to understand what the underlying investment is. So, I mean, to use those examples, I mean, am I investing in an accounting firm or am I investing in an energy pipeline? Totally different animals, even though they're both considered under the same tax structure. But overall, I like investments that have positive cash flow. I like dividend-paying stocks. Dividends have, I think, accounted for over time half of the S&P's total return. So that's certainly appealing. And I also just generally like companies that return capital to their investors.
Sounds good to me.
203-776-9677. Interest rates are crept up a little bit, but they're still historically so low. Why should people, or should they be paying the principal down on a mortgage, even a little bit? Or do you say to yourself, well, interest is so cheap right now, you know, I could invest that money or do something else with it. What's your philosophy about paying down the principal of your mortgage?
Well, one of the inherent biases I have is that for most people, once they reach retirement, let's get the mortgage off the table. So we have one less moving part out there. Now, that's a little bit of a bias that I have. I know that doesn't work for everybody. But once you get to retirement, let's at least have that thing off the table as a given. When you're younger, when you're growing, you're basically taking money from your house and so that you can do other things with it. Hopefully you're doing things like investing. Another dimension to this that most people don't recognize is that when you pay your mortgage, you're in effect doing some forced savings too. And if you get rid of your mortgage, I want to see you take that money and do some forced savings for yourself so it doesn't go away.
Well, there is something kind of thrilling about, I guess, saying to the bank, I'm going to pay off the principal, which means I don't have to pay you all that interest. There's something, you know, there is something pretty thrilling about it. What about this two-speed economy that you've been talking about? When you sent a note about that and said we need to talk about it, I thought, what two-speed economy? What did you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that's unusual, I think a lot of people don't understand, is that part of the economy is actually doing quite well, and some of the employers are really having trouble finding people to fill jobs. And we have another part of the economy that's just doing terribly, and you put them together into statistics and you sort of miss out on what's really happening. So I think this is pretty important to understand. There's some parts of the economy doing very well, whether it's some of the technology, whether it's oil and gas, and other parts are not doing well.
And here's another one. Just as we wind up here, why should we be saving if savings rates are at zero, interest rates?
Well,
why should we be saving?
Presumably you're saving because you need the money into retirement or so that you have something to spend in retirement. And unfortunately, the matter is if they're giving you a low rate of return, you have to save more because you need to build up a certain amount of money. So it's not a question of why save at all. You really should be saving more if you're in a period of low interest rates.
So question one, how much should I save, and whether it's for Mark's short-term goal or whether it's for another person's long-term goal? And then the second question after dealing with that is what should I do with those savings, a low-interest savings account or a more diversified investment?
Well, it's been great having you both on the show, and I'll be interested to see what happens in the next few weeks. I know if everybody's diversified as much as they can possibly be diversified, your rules are that even when the stock market drops the way it has in the past few days, you can still sleep at night. Thank you both very much, Charlie and Bob Kreitler of Kreitler Wealth Management in New Haven. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at wnpr.org. Click on Programs in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.